Welcome to the Marshall Pruitt Podcast, presented by Cooper Tires. My guest this episode is Verizon IndyCar Series President of Competition, Jay Fry. If you followed IndyCar in recent years, hard to deny the overall product has improved on an annual basis. And while there are many people who have contributed to that uprise and that ongoing increase in success, I think Jay Fry is probably at the heart of most of the things fans, drivers, team owners, and otherwise have credited as helping turn the series around. So I thought it'd be great to sit down with Jay. We did this just Saturday while waiting for the Texas IndyCar race to kick off at night and spent right about an hour not so much talking about hardcore racing but wanting to get to know Jay himself. This is an ongoing part of our My Racing Life and Career Marshall Pruitt podcast series. And with Jay being someone whose influence and effects are felt on such a regular basis, I figured getting to know the man was actually something you might enjoy. So we're going to do a part two here sometime soon and talk about specifically the IndyCar bits and everything that he's done while in office there. But this is truly meant to help you get to know Jay Fry the person, where he came from, his upbringing. There's some funny stories in here as well. His story about prom, going to prom. I don't know, man, you're going to have to help me if you've got a story that tops his. But his choice of vehicle, that one right there, is an absolute classic. Spent a lot of time in NASCAR, so we dove into that. Really just spoke a lot about who he was, the things that have helped shape him, the things in racing and outside of racing that have formed his sensibilities, and how those things, again, you can kind of infer that a lot of who he is and what made him who he is a byproduct of that upbringing. And there's also something that we get to see here fairly commonly in IndyCar. You know, you can get every episode of the Marshall Pruitt Podcast on iTunes. You can also get that on Podbean. Would suggest subscribing to both. We also post everything that goes up immediately on the Marshall Pruitt Podcast Facebook page as I speak in third, fourth, or fifth person here. And we also have our Marshall Pruitt YouTube page, which not only do our podcasts now land there as well, got a lot of fun videos going up here, some of them new, a fair amount of retro items, so if I could urge you to subscribe there as well, that would be immensely helpful. And with all that said, let's get going with our man, Jay Fry, in his first long-form sit-down on the Marshall Pruitt Podcast.
Jay Fry, I think folks have gotten to know you extensively in recent years through your role within the Verizon IndyCar series. There's some other series I heard you were involved in before, stock something, some kind of cars there. All kidding aside, I thought we're kind of at that point where I think folks just would like to know more about you, how you got your start in the sport. But let's maybe go back even further than that and just tell us about where you grew up, what that era was like, and then we'll get into maybe how racing intersected with the Fry family.
Gotcha. Well, thank you. Well, thank you for having me. Yeah, I was born in Rock Island, Illinois. Was a big stick and ball sport guy. Actually went to play football at the University of Missouri.
Yeah.
Which is a great experience. Still a big Tiger fan. My first job out of college, I worked for Anheuser-Busch. My first job, I was a special event manager for the city of Chicago. So any event that came into Chicago, I organized it in that local area, which is pretty cool. So that's kind of where I'd always grown up, a motorsports fan, huge fan of motorsports, huge car guy, loved cars, loved working on anything. We had snowmobiles, ATVs. My family was actually in the garbage trucking business. So we can even go back farther than that.
I mean, that's a natural transition from garbage trucking to IndyCar. The normal.
Yeah. So I actually learned how to driving a garbage truck.
How old were you?
10, 11, just like that. Yeah. So what happened when we would have school breaks or whatever, or different times, I would go, I love going on the routes, go and ride the trucks with my dad or whoever. And there would be times we'd be in neighborhoods, and the guy I was with, the driver, would get bored. I mean, you're just going from house to house. So he'd want to get out and get some exercise. So when he did, I would, drive in the neighborhoods. So it was quite cool because there were a lot of places where I would be recognized, because my family had a company or just small towns. There's a small rural area we grew up in. And here I am, I'm 10 or 11, I'm driving this Mack garbage
big
truck.
Old.
Yeah, it's pretty cool, yeah. And then to I guess to complete the garbage truck story, when I was a senior, I took a garbage truck to my senior prom.
You did?
I did, yes. That was pretty fun. So a bunch of guys.
Your date really yeah. happy?
Well, the dates rode in a limo behind us, but oh, me and a friend took a truck.
Good man.
And the reason there was a lot of people bet me that I wouldn't do it. So we did it. You know, it was at the Holodome in Moline, Illinois. So we pulled the truck right up in front. Parked it. Here we go.
Now, do you wash the garbage truck and make it look all nice,
no,
or does it just come straight from the lot?
Right off the lot.
Yeah, oh, okay.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So that was the garbage days.
So the fry boy was driving around in Mac garbage trucks,
yeah,
just kind of
young age.
Yeah, yeah, getting behind the wheel there.
So it was a great summer job because the harder you went, the quicker you got done. Which is right.
Yeah, yeah,
you,
yeah.
You had your route. As soon as you got your route done, you were done. So if we got an 8-hour day done in 4 or 3, we would still get paid for 8.
Wow.
You know, so it was a phenomenal summer job. It was great exercise. You're outside. I love being outside. Again, and that's back in the day when, you know, now everything's automated. You know, you
sure,
know,
sure, sure.
Up the neighborhood, and this is when you had people actually riding on the back and doing it manually. So it was a great experience. You know, it's very proud of my upbringing. My father actually passed away when I was like, 8. So,
really?
Yeah. So it was, this was, my mom owned the company, ran the company until probably middle of college and sold it to a big conglomerate. It was, again, great, great memories.
What's it like losing your father at that age? I mean, I lost my dad when I was 24, 25, yeah, and it just turned my world upside down. But you could easily say, but you're in your almost mid-20s. I mean, you should yeah. be, you know, at least grown enough or man enough to process that better than I did. I can't fathom what it'd be like being 8.
Obviously, we all have things that happen in our lives, and you adapt, and it is what it is. And it was really great. I had, all through my upbringing, you know, because of the sports I played, I had a lot of father figures and coaches. So if, you know, I played basketball, baseball, and football through high school and then football in college. But there was always somebody that plugged in, you know, that was the father figure along the way.
Wow.
And I look back and I'm very grateful, you know, to a lot of friends' dads or coaches or whatever. I never lacked for that. You know, there was always somebody around that was looking after me. And I, again, very grateful that that happened. So, again, I look at, you know, there's never a good time, you know, for something like that to happen to somebody. But I look at, you know, there's been friends now my age whose fathers or mother have passed. And to me, they're lucky, you know, because their father, mother saw them get to this point where mine, you know, didn't, or I didn't get a show, or would he be proud or
sure.
whatever. So, you know, just was kind of heavy stuff. But, yeah, it's kind of where we're at.
So, young and athletic kid, obviously have a fairly solid work ethic as well. I mean, we can take that from what you're already doing kind of in the family business at a young age. Where does that come from?
Because
I've mentioned before, my father was the perfect role model for work ethic.
Yeah.
For whatever reason, it took me, honestly, probably after he died, for me to realize, hey, get your shit in gear, Pruitt.
Yeah.
You can be more and do better.
Yeah.
So I have the perfect role model, but I didn't take advantage of it. It sounds like you might have had your dad for a few years memory-wise, but where did that spark come from within you?
I think probably that partly was him. You know, when I say we owned a garbage trucking company, I think when he passed away, we probably had 10 trucks, you know, which is good. Again, rural farming community was where I grew up in. But, you know, if he didn't perform and didn't work and do what he was supposed to, we didn't eat.
You saw that
as a family, right?
Early on.
So I think about that from a racing team perspective, which is what I did for a long time. It was the same. If we didn't perform on or off the track, there was a lot of families that weren't going to eat.
Mm.
And we took that, or I took that very seriously. So maybe that's, you know, part of it. But I always had this huge fear of failure. You know, I always wanted to do something that others had never done, and that I had to prove myself all along, because it was just...
That's a powerful thing.
Right, it was just me. I didn't have anything to fall back on. I had great, you know, great childhood upbringing. My mom was, you know, phenomenal with raising 2 kids, you know, by herself. So, but I always felt like I had to kind of carry the load and had to prove myself and had to withhold the family name and, you know, that type of thing. So,
And that sense of duty as well, that was my next question. I mean, we've spoken about your dad a bit, but your mom, I haven't met her, haven't had the fortune of knowing her, but she sounds like someone who strength is just a given, right? Because, yeah. I mean, a family can crumble faced with adversity like that, but like she's the hero.
Yeah, absolutely. She had an 8-year-old and a 4-year-old. I have a sister, younger sister, and had a business to run, you know, by herself. And she was always involved. She always managed the business side of it, the you know, accounting and things. But then when he died, you know, she had to pick up the whole thing. So it was a very, so this has been like 72, 73. So it was a very male-centric business, you know, and then she's happy to run this. And it was just, it was tough, I'm sure. Yeah. I look back and I'm very proud of her and amazed at what she did. Again, as you get older, you start appreciating things like that more. So I, in the last few years, have actually called a few people that were influential and maybe they didn't realize they were to thank them for, they're pretty neat calls. You know, we're all getting older. And while some of these gentlemen or anybody are around, I just wanted to let them know that, you know, they meant a lot and just called them to them.
So sports is obviously a pretty natural outlet for you on the education side coming up through school, high school and college. What interested you? And I ask because the business side, while you might be, you know, your role today is competition president, not vice president, as I occasionally mistakenly write. And I love getting the text from you like,
I got demoted
man,
again.
Man, I got demoted it's again. A, and I'm like,
and I'm not into titles. So I don't care.
Oh, I know, but I just love it because I'm like,
it's a joke.
I should have told him before he got demoted. But business has been running, you know, you aren't just playing with race cars today, beforehand, running teams at NASCAR and such. This isn't just playing with wheels and tires and such. There's businesses to run. Was that an interest at all on the educational side when you were growing up?
Yeah, so my degree was in actually marketing education. So it was in Missouri, you could go basically a marketing business type degree. On the from a business school perspective or the education perspective in different schools. So I went the education school route so I could get a teaching certificate, which I have.
Yeah.
I got that because I wasn't exactly sure what I was going to do when I got out of school. So I thought if I ever wanted to get into coaching or something like that, that's something back then you had to have to teach or coach at a high school. So it was pretty cool. One of the things I was able to do, part of that, you had to student teach to get your degree.
Wow.
So I went back to my old high school to student teach. So here I am, 22, what-ish, right? And, you know, there's friends of mine's brothers and sisters who are now seniors, you know, that have seen things and been around me that probably things that most students wouldn't have seen their teacher do.
Keep it down over there. Yeah, don't right? tell anybody. Yeah. Come on.
Over the years at their house or whatever, when I would be hanging out with their siblings. So it was again, great experience. Even then, there was a lot of teachers and coaches who were had helped up bring me up that I came back and did this. And it's funny, my I can't remember what the term was. My teacher, who was my person for the 12 weeks, my supervising teacher, was the athletic director at the school. And I think the first day he checked me in to do, you know, here we go. And then 12 weeks later, I saw him again. So it was like a nice vacation for me.
Wow.
You got it, right? You're good. Go get them. Okay, so here we go. But it was cool. So I never that's been the only time I ever taught was that time frame. Again, I got my degree in that and then got the job with Anheuser-Busch. And, I mean, right off the bat, it was I was around the Junior Johnson stuff.
Yeah.
So I'm doing a lot of different things. And, again, growing up, you know, always working on, you know, again, we had – what was cool, going back to the garbage days again, our guys would bring stuff back to our shop, and it was, you know, one man's trash is another man's treasure.
Sure.
So it'd be pedal cars or just stuff that needed fixed, and they would bring it back and fix them up and send them home with my dad.
Wow.
So I had this garage full of, I mean, I wish I still had this stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, old metal pedal cars and things like that. So we were always tinkering and doing things, and I think mechanically I was always inclined. I just never did that, you know, and then that's part of when we got to a team perspective. It's funny, we would be in engineering meetings, and I'm not an engineer, but the guys would be, you know, or the engineers would be telling me, here's what we're doing, we're going to do this, this, and this. And then I would always stop them. It's like, well, what about this? And oh, we didn't, you know, we did the, there's, you know, a little bit of a common sense approach that you have to take on everything you do. And sometimes that wasn't happening. Like they would build this incredible space shuttle. They're going to send it to the moon with two people on it. And I'd look at it and I'm like, well, where's the doors? Well, what do you mean? Well, those two people got to get out when they get there, right?
Yeah.
Good point. Yeah. So it just, I mean, I've sat through, you know, thousands of hours of meetings like that. So I you know, when people come in and talk now about whatever technically, I certainly am capable of understanding what they're talking about. And I've been around it for a long time. So I get it, I guess is the thing.
So
it's hard to BS me, I guess.
Well, I mean, the practical part I would say is, you know, if you were to poll a lot of people in the IndyCar garage, for sure, that practical approach is one of the unique things that has been brought to the series in recent years. But let's go back to how you pivot from looking after major events in Chicago for Anheuser-Busch, which I'm sure that was valuable for you, because it sounds like a fairly dynamic thing, meaning I just have to put on and or do a whole bunch of different things that might not be in my wheelhouse, might not be my expertise, but I have to figure it out. What was that like?
Well, yeah, I look back on that. Again, like you reflect, right? I mean, what a phenomenal job coming out of college. So here I am in the Chicago's a phenomenal city. I have access to tickets to everything. I mean, you know, just so how it would kind of work would be if we had a national program come to town, so the Rolling Stones, you know, the Budweiser Steel Wheels Tour, whatever it was back in the day, they would come into Chicago. Well, then we would operate. We would run that piece of it. So we would do that to doing the a street festival at the Cabernica Center. You know, so it was little local event, little local things in the city to major attractions coming to town. So you were juggling a lot of different things. You were meeting a lot of different people. You know, there was a lot of very influential. It was a great learning experience on the people you got to meet. I mean, we dealt with the Bulls and the Bears, the Cubs, what we didn't do with the White Sox, Loyola, Northwestern. So it was, you know, interesting to people, you know, here at a very young age, you know, really good experience. And that led into, again, I got to meet a lot of people in the motorsports world at that time. And I knew I really wanted to do that. So at AB, I kept getting promoted and kind of got to a point where I got promoted above that job at Anheuser-Busch because they had somebody that ran their NASCAR program. They had a sports marketing department. They had a NASCAR piece, an IndyCar piece. You know, everybody had a program manager. And I got kind of above that. And the job opened, the NASCAR one, and I wanted to do it. And they're, well, you can't do it. Well, why can't I? Because it would be a demotion. You'd be going backwards. You don't do that here. And I'm like, well, I'd like to do that. So they wouldn't let me. And met some people at Valvoline. And Valvoline had an opening basically to run their NASCAR program and World Outlaws. So I was fortunate enough to go do that. And I'd never forget my exit interview at Anheuser-Busch. They were like, what is your problem?
It's like, this is the dumbest thing anybody's
ever done. I mean, you don't leave this company. I mean, people don't leave there.
Yeah.
Back then, I mean, it was a phenomenal job. I mean, I was.
You got a job for life.
Yeah, and a great company. They take great care of their people. And here I am now. And I took a big pay cut to go do that. You know, so it's like, you're brilliant. Right. So that's part of reflecting. You go, well, that's how I ended up where I am today. So I'm grateful. But it was kind of a big swing. So I started with Valvoline in, I guess it was late 91, early 92. And then, and that's how that part started. But it was that program. I worked with Steve Kinzer and the World Outlaw, our World Outlaw team at the time. We had just put together the deal with Mark Martin. To do that car. And then the next year we put together a deal with Hendrick, with Rick, which at the time, you know, you look back, it was probably one of the first B2B deals that were done in the sport. So it was an oil deal for the dealerships, and we got, you know, we were on all the cars.
Interesting.
Yeah, and at that time, that was end of 92, so 93 was Jeff's first year. So Jeff Gordon's rookie year, so we were part of that program. It was actually kind of around when they hired him, and you know, it's kind of neat to be part of that. I really need to be part of that.
So with the events that you were looking after for Anheuser-Busch, there's not obviously a lot of planning, but there's budgeting involved. I mean, there has to be, there's a lot of work that would go into such a thing. What did you take from that role into this very specific role of looking after sponsorship for Valvoline and NASCAR and World of Outlaws? Because I'm sure that, you know, you're having to do same kind of budgeting, lots of planning. But how hands-on was that for you? Because obviously, you know, not too long after, you said, well, okay, maybe the team side is going to be for me. But I'm just curious how much of what you would do later, you know, running team, ownership side, et cetera, were you forming in this stage here at Valvoline?
Well, I think it was all of the above. One of the things, everything we do is about people, right? So, again, it's about the people you meet, and it's how do you interact with people, and then when you manage people, it's how you treat your people. And so I think the Anheuser-Busch experience was really phenomenal regarding the people. I mean, you know, back then they're making friends as our business, and, you know, all this stuff, you know, it's that was very important. And then, too, if you think about these events, you know, these events are going to happen whether you're ready or not, right? So it's the same thing what we do, right? I mean, you're under the gun all the time.
It's on the calendar.
Yeah, so there's this time thing. So, again, we're going to race tonight, right? You know, at 7:53 or whatever, we're going to have a green flag, and hopefully, you know, or weather or whatever. There's always things you got to adapt to, but, you know, it helped with time management, helped with, you know, being organized and, you know, making sure that the whole group was on the same page, because it wasn't obviously just me, like it's not just me right now. There's lots of people involved. Everybody's got to be pulling the same direction and knowing what we're doing. So I think that correlated, you know, then, and it correlates now. It's the same, you know, same thing we do now. So it was good. It was really, that was a very, you know, funny, we talk about leaving AB and how traumatic that was for them. It wasn't for me. I wanted to do what I wanted to do. And traumatic. But it was funny. I'd never forget the exit interview. My boss at the time was looking at me like, you know, like his head spinning. Like, what is wrong with you? So when I talk about mentors over the years, he was one of them. A phenomenal guy. So at AB, I think I had, I don't know, four, five, six different jobs over. That was the first one. Over a four-year period. So, I mean, I was, you know, things were going really well. But I always, this guy was always the guy who kind of mentored me through. And, you know, he just looked like, oh, my gosh. So I talked to him last few years, too, you know, on that. Thank you for your help. And for not talking me out of what I wanted to do. So, but no, it all fits together.
So tell me about this journey of yours in NASCAR. Because to go, of the many things I love about our sport, there aren't many linear stories. I woke up and decided I wanted to be a NASCAR team owner.
Absolutely.
And I just followed straight down this direct path and became one. It's this scattershot thing of, I'm driving the garbage truck to my prom.
Yep.
I'm doing street fairs over here. There's just this weaving back and forth. How do you go from this first real hands-on thing with Valvoline to, okay, maybe I'm getting closer to this passion of mine, but how do I take those final steps? Yeah. What was that like?
Well, it's exactly right on how I think – 90% of the people in motorsports are like that, right? You almost think of it like we're all mutts, kind of like we all kind of come from this diverse background, and how do we all get here? And the other 10% are probably, you know, that their families have been in it for a long time, or their dad did it and they did it, and, you know, there's a lot of that, too. But it was cool. So when we did the deal with Rick and Hendrick Motorsports, I did it for a year. Valvoline's headquarters is based out of Lexington, Kentucky, so I was living there. And I was gone all the time. I mean, I was never. And you can't get to Lexington, Kentucky from anywhere. You know, it's one of those things. So in year two of it, Rick offered up a building at Hendrick that I could use. We just had to upfit it a little bit, and I could make it my shop. And, you know, I could house out of Charlotte. So fortunately, the Valvoline agreed, and so I moved to Charlotte, fixed this building up. And it's funny, it was the Bug Barn. And what it was Harry Hyde, back in the day, restored his bugs in there.
Wow.
Yes, this building's got great history. So
wow.
It had a paint booth in it. It had, you know, small, I mean, 20 by, not a big building. So we went in and we cleaned
I'm having visions of Days of Thunder here.
Exactly. I mean, very much so. So the paint booth, we had sheetrocked, put a drop ceiling in it. That was my office. And we're talking 93, you know, so again, you did what you had to do. But what a cool experience. So my, we're up on top of the hill at Hendrick, and the building next to the Bug Barn was the 25 shop. So that's where Schrader's team was run out of. And then the other team at that point was down the hill, and the engine shop was down the hill, and then the 24 came the next year. So that's how I got down there. So during that time period, I was around those guys a lot. And it was a really great experience because if you look at, I mean, Jack Roush is now a Hall of Famer and does things spectacularly. I mean, phenomenal guy, great guy. Learned a ton from him, but has one approach. I mean, or he has a different approach. He's an engineering-focused, you know, very black and white background, very just very technical, very but hugely successful. So the other time, at this other time, per this time period, then I'm dealing with Rick Hendrick, who is, you know, a people person, business guy, you know, huge car dealer conglomerate, just completely different approaches, but hugely successful in both their rights. So I was, here I am again, 20, whatever, hanging around those two, you know, those guys like that. And just, I'm learning everything. The osmosis is just running rampant right now. You know, because you just see how things are. I like that. I like that. You know, I wouldn't do it that way. I would do that. So you're just learning as you go. And I was really lucky in, let's see, it was early part of 1996. Funny how this works because this wouldn't happen nowadays. But M&M's went to Rick to start a fourth team at the time. And he didn't want to at that time. So he had three friends that were interested in becoming team owners. See, put me with them, and that's how that team got started. So I was the managing operator partner. So at, I don't know, 29, 30 years old, something like that, we started a cup team from scratch with his, Rick Hendrick's support, which was phenomenal. But it was
an amazing opportunity, though.
Unbelievable.
I mean, that you usually get either the existing team owner that wants to expand in-house, or you get the somewhat wealthy person coming in and starting from scratch. It's kind of rare when you get the, I don't really want to add any more, but hey, I've got some perfect people to put you together with to take to take off here. It's something in the middle I haven't heard a lot about.
Yeah. What's cool, and that's how he is, right? So what one of the things is with them, we struck a technical alliance with Hendrick Motorsports. We were partners with them. Obviously, it was good for them. We leased engines from them. So it was a really great relationship. Again, I look back at when we started the team, I think we had, you know, 13 people in an 8,000 square foot shop, you know, and you know, in 98, we sat on the pole at the Brickyard 400 with Ernie Irvin. And it was a really, you at that point in your life, you don't know what you don't know.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So you're like, hey, yeah, we can do this. And we went and did it. And we were very fortunate to have, again, mentors around us that were very helpful. That didn't lead us astray. So it was a great experience.
So what are you learning at this point that, I don't want to say you didn't know, what are you learning at this point, big picture wise? Because it sounds like you'd be in a position where you're drinking from the proverbial fire hose of career going forward. I've done a lot of diverse things. I've managed things, but this seems like a big step up in terms of management and oversight. Was this something where you were feeling like, geez, you know, secure in what you were doing, a little bit unsure? I mean, what's your feeling about where you're at?
Well, this is the first time, you know, when you're with Valvoline and you're with AB before that. I mean, you have a huge, you know, you have a huge group behind you. This is the first time you're really an entrepreneur, kind of independent.
Yeah.
And again, I was lucky. I had, you know, the three owners, partners, and then the Hendrick support and that type of thing. But really, it's the first time where you're really responsible for the day-to-day of somebody's, again, if you don't perform, these people you just hired that now have entrusted you with their livelihoods, you know, if you don't perform, you let them down.
Because that's the part that I think fascinates me, because you go from looking after Valvoline, not saying that there, you know, you didn't have people that you were, you know, you weren't doing this solo, but right. I mean, for the most part, it's not as if you're looking after, like you said, 8,000 square foot shop, 13 people and such. What was that like, taking on that burden?
Yeah. Well, again, looking back, you don't know at that age what you don't know. It was a huge responsibility, and but it was one that we took very seriously and were very proud to do. And then again, that team, you know, expanded. It went from that in 96 to 2007. We had, you know, 160 people in a 200,000 square foot building. So we grew, you know, and as that sport grew, we grew along with it. But it was funny that's when it really.
And that was the MB2 team?
Yeah. That's when it really hit. So back in the early part, if my little financial empire that I have, which is I could cover things. I could, you know, if payroll was whatever, I could fix things. I could do things more, you know, what I needed to do. But by 2007, with 150 people, jeez. I mean, if it was really stressful because, again, if things started going kind of, which you hear about all the time, I mean, you have a fully funded car, everything's great, and all of a sudden that company goes bankrupt
yeah.
or something. And then all of a sudden, like, what do we do? I mean, there's moments like that in everybody's storyline at some point. So that it got really stressful at that point. And that's, as you would see in NASCAR at that time, a lot of teams were consolidating. There was a lot of
yep.
industry consolidation. There was a lot of stuff going on. And then we became part of that in 2008 because it just got, it was getting... It was intense at that point. So
tell me about this wandering path with MB2. I mean, I think where many folks outside of NASCAR might have first heard about you was with the Red Bull NASCAR program. Yeah. You know, a little bit further down the road in the 2000s and such, but. Where are you at on a personal level as you're getting into, you know, multiple years of being in charge of a team, running a team, ownership stake, et cetera? Are you feeling like this is my life? This, you know, I'm going to retire at 75 years old as a Cup owner? Or are you feeling at that point that I've done a lot of different things in my life? Who knows? Maybe this NASCAR is just a destination, but not necessarily the finish sure. line for me.
Well, good question. I certainly thought I was all in. I still think I'm all in. It was pretty cool to be part of. You think about from like 1990 to say 2000, how that sport grew. I mean, there was a lot of. I mean, it was amazing what happened in that 10-year run. To be part of that as it went, it was pretty spectacular. So again, this sport is very unique, motorsports in general. I think if you look at it, probably 50% of it's a normal business model. It's how you'd run any business. Yeah. The other 50% is pretty unique to what we do.
Wacky.
Yeah, right. So it's funny, like coming from NASCAR team stuff to IndyCar, even the team stuff, if you look at that as a 80% of it's the same of what they do. And 10% of it's unique to an IndyCar team per se.
Sure. Know?
But it's really motorsports. I mean, it's you race cars. Here's what we do. So there's some nuances that IndyCar is a little different than NASCAR. But in general, it's racing cars. So when I came over here, I felt like I had a really good understanding of the teams, how they operated, what they did. Had some good relationships already. You know, there's crossover owners, Chip, Roger, they're Chevrolet, there was crossovers and lots of people you knew. When I come here, it was really cool to, develop a great relationship with the Honda people, the Firestone people, things like that, that, you know, we didn't have because they weren't part of
yeah.
that sport. So, I think my motorsports sport background has just expanded, you know, since I've come here. So, it's a great sport. We think about, we're all looking forward to next weekend. Having it off.
Yes.
Right. Are we on off? Right. But you go, okay, once next weekend comes, we're all like, you know, what do you do?
I know. Feels strange. You're sitting around like.
Yeah. Yeah. You get excited about
unplug the robot from what yeah. he normally does on a daily basis.
And then, you know, you look around and you're like, and this, especially back in the NASCAR, you know, the 38 weekend thing. I mean, on an off weekend, you look around, you didn't know any of your neighbors. You didn't know anybody because you're never there, right?
I forgot I had a dog.
Right, yeah. So, you know, you end up, you know, getting together with the people you're on the road with all the time anyway when you're at home on an off weekend, yeah. Which is social. It's fun. It's, you know, off weekends are great. And this group, wow, it deserves one next weekend for sure. The sport is a great education. It's great to be around it. It does apply to lots of different things in the world. So you could take what you learned in this world and put it basically anywhere and be successful, just because of what all you have to do and how hard it is. And I think a lot of people who come into the sport who have never been in it, there's an eye-opening experience,
yeah, yeah.
You know, because we definitely, you have to have a sense of urgency to be in the sport. You have to get it done now. You can't wait. You know, again, we're going to race tonight. You know, the teams need paid next week. This needs to happen. It's not that you have a two-year window to plan to get it ready to do whatever. You've got to go now. And I think that's there's, you know, revenue sharing and, you know, different things like that that are, you know, the teams are independent. You know, and it's, I mean, we as a series, you know, we're looking at different ways to do different things. And there's the leader circle and different things like that. NASCAR has plan money, but it's a tough business model. Takes tough people.
So continuing on the business model trend, where do conversations start coming out of Germany with a particular energy drink company? Yeah. Because that to me seems not as if you haven't done a lot of fascinating things, but that seems particularly fascinating. Because it isn't Skittles, it isn't, you know, it isn't just kind of one of these American bread and butter things. It's
well,
like,
let's even go. Let's
so
go.
You want to The Formula One team wants NASCAR. Yeah. Okay.
Well, let's go back. You want one thing I forgot on the MB2 days. So that was one of the proudest moments of that time frame was in 2000, I guess it was 2004-ish. Again, my years get mixed up sometimes. We brought the U.S. Army in as a sponsor of one of our teams. And that was a unbelievable experience. You know, you're not representing a brand. You're representing an institution.
Yes.
You know, and there was all this stuff going on in the world at that time. And, you know, when... at that time, we had, you know, President Bush and Secretary Rumsfeld and Vice President Cheney and people like that would come when they come to a race. They would come hang out with our team. I mean, and we got to meet the Secret Service guys and got to know them on a first name basis.
Wow.
And it just was just this phenomenal experience. And we would be in the back of the truck, you know, talking to, you know, Vice President Cheney or Secretary Rumsfeld, and they're talking about something. You're like going, I don't. And then, you know, a month later, you'd hear about it on the news or something. It was like, you know, just stuff that you're, this is like, wow. So that was kind of cool. One time with the vice president had his granddaughters with him, and they were fascinated by the truck, right? I mean, like, wow, it's got a kitchen in it. You know, there's cars up on top. Yeah, I mean, you think about it, a little kid that had never been in something like that, it's pretty neat looking what's all in one of these trucks, transporters. So we're going around, they see the refrigerator, and I open it up. I'm like, we have these, you know, the Icy Pops. And I ask, do you mind, can they have one? They're, you know, no problem. So I get them out and get the colors they want, and okay, how are we going to open them? So I open this drawer, and this drawer's got, you know, kitchen utensils in it.
Yes.
You know, big ones.
Ooh.
So we're like, you know, I think some people got in trouble at that point because they hadn't cleared the area necessarily. Yeah. So we couldn't find anything. End of the day, the vice president pulls out a Swiss Army knife and uses scissors. Yeah. So just, again, you look, that's what is so cool about motorsports. Stuff like this is not everyday stuff, you know, that happens in your life. And you look back, everybody out here's got stories like that, that they've met people or been around people that's unique and amazing. And that leading into your question, the Red Bull piece. So in, middle of 2007, we merged with DEI. So MB2, who at that point had become GIN Racing. So in 2006, the original partners sold to Bobby Ginn. We rebranded the name Ginn. It was the same team. I was still involved, whatever. A year later, then we merged the team with DEI. That's when all this consolidation was starting to happen. At that point, we had to, because of the consolidation, there were some people that had to go. And that was one of the most traumatic days in my life. There was people that had been with me since day one that now all of a sudden didn't have a position. So
what's it like? I assume this isn't something you learned about from someone else overnight. I'm sure that this is part of conversations and negotiations for this, you know, how the consolidation came together. What's it like hearing that there's going to have to be some personnel changes for all this to go forward? What are you doing? I mean, is this something I'm sure you fought, but what's that process like? Because that, again, that's one of those layers of racing.
Yeah.
I guess it's probably
horrible.
The same with any other company, but what's it like going through that?
It was a whole, I mean, this could be a whole 1 hour or this whole, the way this went down. When we were going to merge with them, the original intention of how it was going to work was much different than how it ended up. And how it ended up, I was not for at the time, but I really had no choice because that team is a minority owner in the team.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's certain things that you can do and not do. So it ended up being what it was. And again, then at that point, there was consolidation of people, and that was really bad. And I was made sure there was a role for me going forward with that group.
Yep.
And I didn't do it. I, you know, when they read who was not coming, I wanted my name first because I wasn't going to go do something with and not have these other people that were with me for so long have the same opportunity.
Mm.
So at that point, I was, I guess, for easier to out of a job when we merged. And I wasn't exactly sure what I was going to do, but I knew I could go do something with Rick Hendrick. There was this come consult, come help me, that type thing. And that was cool. I mean, that was a great opportunity possibly. But I had a couple months there where I had to help him transition the DEI piece, did that. And then out of the blue, I got a call from Toyota. And they're like, hey, Red Bull has got some things going on. They need somebody. We've recommended you. That's great. I mean, I'd never worked with Toyota at that point ever. And I was, flattered that they thought of me.
It's pretty amazing to just come out of left field.
Yeah.
To know, I mean, that's another thing that's you find in this sport, and again, I'm sure in life as well, that you never know who's watching.
Right.
You never know who's paying attention.
Right.
And
absolutely.
You're going to have your detractors. God, I wouldn't hire that guy to
right.
do, you know, such and such. But then a manufacturer you'd never worked with is saying, hey, we have an opportunity we're seeing here.
Yeah.
And they call
Remember
you.
At that point, that was their first year, too.
Yeah.
First full-time year. So, I'd never dealt with them really at all. I got a great call, and they said, you know, if you're okay, we'll have somebody call you. Absolutely. So literally that afternoon or the next morning, Dr. Marco.
Helmut Marco
yes. calls me. You know, hey, we would like to talk to you. I'm like, it sounds great. We would like to have you come over to Austria to talk to you. Perfect. When should you come? And he's like, can you come today, basically? What do you mean? Like today?
Should I start
like
swimming now?
Yeah, like now? What's the deal? He goes, well, so literally, I can't remember exactly, but it was almost like he might have called me that afternoon, and then the next day at 3 o'clock, I'm on a flight to Austria. The way it worked, out of Charlotte, you'd leave at 3, land in Frankfurt, if I remember right, and then you'd fly to Salzburg, and then you'd get into Austria to Salzburg, noonish. So I got in at like noonish, and like by two-ish, I was meeting with Dr. Margo. Yeah. So great meeting, went really well. He seemed really interested. Good. So we, you know, whatever. And then I went back to the hotel because the next morning I had a 6 o'clock flight out. And he started calling me that night. Hey, we want to do this. And, you know, I'm like, okay. And
so what are you leaving? I mean, granted, you don't have much time to prepare, but are you just catching a flight with the mindset of, hey, I'll go sit down and talk? Or are you going there thinking, well, they're probably going to ask me what it's going to cost for one car, two car, staff size? I mean, what are you preparing for, and how much are you looking to either arm them with big info on how to participate, or is this more, you feel like a one-on-one personal interview?
It was a little both, right? I think it was all the information that they would need, it was secondhand to me because I had been doing it for 24 hours a day, 7 days a week for 12 years. So it was very easy to, here's how we operated. Here's what I see out of your guys. He asked a lot of questions about, I mean, we'd been competing, you know, all year, that year with those teams to that point. And, you know, here are little, you know, if you think of in 2007, that was the year that Mark, we lost the Daytona 500 by a foot to Kevin Harvick. I mean, that was that team. So our team was a good team. We led the points the first 7 weeks. You know, it was a good, you know, so how did my little team that was not funded nearly like the Red Bull team, how did it perform at a much higher level than the Red Bull team who's had a lot of money at that point? So there was a lot of that, but they certainly thought they I knew they needed somebody. I knew the reason why they wanted me to come over because it was Lee White with Toyota who had called. He went through the whole thing. So I was, you know, prepared to talk about that. But I didn't know because, again, I still at that point wasn't sure what I wanted to do. So I wasn't going over there as almost – I think I was interviewing him as much as he was interviewing me.
Yeah.
You know, because I always thought I would end up doing something with Rick and that thing. And I was fully prepared to do that because that's – if it's funny if you go back to the MB2 thing again – when we did the MB2 deal original, Rick put me with those gentlemen, and we started. His thing was always help get these guys started. And at the time, he had a gentleman named Jimmy Johnson, not the driver, another guy named Jimmy Johnson, running Hendrick Motorsports. And he's like, we go help them get going for 2 or 3 years, and then you come over. When Jimmy retires, you come back, you come over here. Perfect. Great plan. So, you know, that never – MB2 lasted for, you know, 11, 12 years, so – it didn't quite work out like we thought. So I thought I would do that. And but I really enjoyed my conversation with Dr. Marco. I was mesmerized by the, you know, the F1 team and this, that. I mean, there was just all this stuff. And it's like, this is, again, I, you know, was fortunate in all these times we talked about, learn and be around different things. And I, at that point, I'd not really done anything internationally.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, and I look at this as an international thing at that point. So basically, we talked that night, you know, and he said, well, the next, when you land, you know, write up what you need, how it would work, what we got to do, what do you think, and send it to me. And, you know, so I did that when I landed. And, you know, I got back something very quickly that, hey, let's do it. Let's go. Okay. So I call Rick and say, these guys want me to go do this. What do you think? He says, well, absolutely. It's very important to the sport that Red Bull's successful and that they stay around. And, you know, this is good. This, again, that's part of motorsports too, right? I mean, most people look at it holistic.
Yeah.
I mean, if it's good for IndyCar, you know, it's good for all of us, you know, that's a good thing. And that was, you know, his approach at that point was, you know, this is good. We want, you know, we need, you know, Toyota to be around. We need Red Bull to be around. Go, you know, perfect. Okay, so we started that, you know, there.
So let's talk about this as we start to wind down towards the end of this. And as I mentioned to you before we started, IndyCar really wasn't going to be much of a topic today because I figure that's a whole.
Yeah, I feel bad. We're talking. You know, yeah.
Well, but that. It's a perfect excuse to find time for part two.
Gotcha.
I
love what I'm doing.
Like I said, what I don't want to do is try and rush into that because I think that's probably one of the more fascinating points to take everything we will have spoken about today and then look at how that's been distilled into so many of the things you're doing with the IndyCar series. Tell me about this rare opportunity to have a giant company like Red Bull basically say, yeah, all right, let's go.
Right.
I mean, that's the dream. That's everybody's dream. And
huge.
A, that never happens
never.
For the most part.
No.
But you also can't be the guy that abuses that willingness and trust, right? Oh, well, you know, we need 8,000 people and we need a trillion square foot shop.
I did the opposite.
Right? So, again, tell me about that because you obviously know you have a once-in-a-lifetime thing here. But you don't want to be the person that says, well, hey, they're a big company. They make a lot of money. Boy, we're all going to get fat and rich off of this.
Yeah. No, it's funny. So we go do the deal. And I'm like 100%. I get in there. I look at the budgets and I'm, you know, blown away. I mean, again, it's looking at what I became even prouder of what we did at an MB2, knowing what we were racing against.
Mm.
Right. I mean, just again, there is you have to have proper funding, right? But I'm a big believer in ingenuity and, you know, people, and that can overcome lack of resources sometimes. But I looked at the numbers and immediately slashed a lot of things.
Really?
Yeah. And I got a call like, you know, what's wrong with you? What's wrong? I'm like, well, sir, this is crazy. We don't need this. We don't need to spend this on this. We don't need to do this on this. Here's lots of millions back.
What was something that you saw and you're like, okay, I'm sure that there was justification for it, but I think we could trim that.
Yeah, at the time, they were working on building seats, right? Which is, again, in the cup thing, there's a couple seat manufacturers, and they're approved by NASCAR. And Red Bull would have had to get NASCAR approval to do this. And it wasn't, I just didn't feel like it was going to happen. And they spent all this money over a period of time, and they really weren't getting the project completed either. It wasn't like they came up with like this, wow. And how would NASCAR not approve this? It was like, we keep messing around and we're not there anyway. Mm. And we spent, astronomical amounts of money on the seat. You can go buy store-bought ones.
Yeah.
I mean, that they customized each driver, you know, and be done with it. And I just thought the focus was wrong. That first year, Red Bull, you know, if you have a two-car team, there's 36, right, whatever. There's 72 opportunities to make a race. I think they missed 33.
Jeez.
I mean, it was bad. I mean, you know, so I just looked at it. We got to stop. We got to quit worrying about building seats. We got to start worrying about making races. I mean, that seat's not going to make you make a race.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? I mean, so let's back up here. Let's common sense. Let's do some of the basic stuff, right? Let's get like everybody else.
Too much of a specialist mentality out of the gate.
And once we get like everybody else, then we can start working on things. You know, let's start doing the blocking and tackling, the basic stuff right. We got good drivers. We can make this stuff happen. We got good support. Let's just kind of reset. So that's what we did. But it was cool. One of the things, too, on the international piece. So two or three times a year, I'd have to go back to Austria and we were called a corporate project because Red Bull, again, it was different. Red Bull owned the team, right? You know, Red Bull wasn't just the sponsor.
Yeah, yeah.
They owned it. So it was me, Christian Horner, and Franz Tost would have to go meet. So we met at Mr. Manischitz had this really cool barn out in Fuschel up on this hill. Just spectacular. You go to this beautiful white barn, and you go in, and it's like, wow, there's a wow to the inside. It was usually Christian and I would be like downstairs on deck. Franz would be up doing his, and we had to be there all day because you never knew when you would be. So we might be sitting down there for hours until it was our turn.
Now, what was this like? I mean, Midwestern boy running a NASCAR. I mean, you're bleeding red, white, and blue. Here you're now a part of an important part of this Austrian energy drink empire with its showcase Formula One team, plus its B team, the farm team. I'm not saying fish out of water, but you, Franz Tost, and Christian Horner in a room, that's not like a natural drinking trio when you would think of it firsthand, but that was actually in reality.
It was great. Again, at that point, this, like you said, to me, Formula One was like James Bond type stuff, right, at that point. And then through the course of the next couple of years, I went over to the F1 shop a couple of times, and it was funny, at the front of the shop, or the front of the factory, it is. You know, there's this James Bond, you know, there's all this simulation and art, you know, all this stuff going on. But in the back, you got some guys bolting cars together.
Yeah.
I mean, they're just mechanics bolt. That's us. I mean, you know, so it was really cool to see the similarities. And in reality, the F1 guys were mesmerized by what we did. I mean, they're like, you know, you race 38 weekends. How does that happen? And blah, blah, blah. And, well, I mean, we're going from, you know, Atlanta to Charlotte to, I mean, it was a much different, you know, they're going from, I don't know, China to wherever. I mean, you know, the travel was much different. But it was really just great friendships, for, you know, still. But it was really interesting to understand how they did stuff. And we helped them with some things. They helped us with a lot of different things. We collaborated a lot. So it was, you know, we laughed about simulation. There was one time that, you know, that it was thought that we should be able to simulate a race. You know, you should have your strategy, you know, done before the race. So I'm like, okay, well, so you strategize a 500-lap race at Bristol, Tennessee, with 43 cars, 13 cautions, and what you
get back to me on
you
that
give
one.
Me back how that, you see how that works. So they tried it. Really? It like blew up there. It's impossible, right? You can't, you don't, I mean, that's part of what, where the people come in, right? You got, you know, your crew chief's got to, you know, you got to have a feel for what's going on. You got to, I mean, you've got data, you know, you understand it, but there's things that got to happen. It's got to happen right now.
Yeah. I
and
mean,
it's just different.
Oh, you've got this cute 53 lap race with 20 cars on a 3-point-something mile track.
Yeah.
You simulate that, no problem. Right. You, as soon as you tell us how you figured out our game.
Yeah.
Boy, we got a job for you.
It was so
you.
Fun because, again, it was more just challenging each other, and the collaboration was great. And Christian, they're all still friends. Jonathan Wheatley's the team manager at Red Bull. You know, great guy, good friend, great friend. And, I mean, they're still today. I mean, there's stuff I send them. Hey, what do you think about this? How's this work? What do you guys do? I mean, you know, just kind of, again, understanding globally how motorsports works, and you got to stay on top of all of it. So, it was just part of this evolution of, again, what – motorsports has done for me, I mean, that, right? You just went international and your scope just grew exponentially. So, and then coming here in IndyCar, same, you know, the Firestones and the Honda people, you know, you just, it grown exponentially. So very fortunate. I mean, it's been a lot, and there's a lot to do yet to go. So this chapter or this is not even close to being over, or I hope. Unless you've heard something again.
Well, if I just got a text. You
I
are,
just got demoted again.
Yes, no,
you didn't get fired. You got fired this time.
Perfect. You know, you're the superintendent of competition.
Thank you.
So, well, let's close on this again, I guess, for part one. But that's one of the reasons I love doing these podcasts because, I had no expectation that in 1 hour we were going to compress your life. So this Red Bull experience I know was invaluable for you professionally, but that comes to an end in NASCAR. What's the path from there forward to IndyCar? Because when I first read of your coming into the series, it wasn't competition director.
Right.
It was something where, if I'm thinking of frontline people who were seeing on camera at every race, that wasn't your role. But tell me about that kind of in-between period of the end of, you know, where your NASCAR journey ends and either interest from IndyCar comes in. Do they reach out to you? How does that
– Yeah.
What's that part like for you?
So the Red Bull, it was the end of 2011 when that piece ended. And then in 2012, I did finally go do the thing with Rick Hendrick where I did some consulting, some projects. He was – phenomenal to me. It was a great, I felt almost like it was a gap year. It kind of let me kind of catch my breath, did a bunch of things for them or tried to do some things for them.
And I find a lot of people in motor racing, if it's not a gap year, it's gap years. There's usually a point, and I can say this from my own experience, there's usually a point where you go, man, I've been on the clock for a long time here. Wouldn't it be great to either step away or just do something very different that isn't as hectic? To kind of, whether it's take stock of where you want to go next or just take a breath. So
yes, that was
that as well.
100%. So it was still motorsports related, obviously. But it was good because, again, being around them for a year, I'd been around them for a really long time. Not so much, but even in the Red Bull days, think about it. So we hired Casey Kane. He was on loan to us from Hendrick.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? So, I mean, even even at Red Bull, we did some stuff with Hendrick, you know, so had been around them for a long, long time. I was able to be around them, you know, quite a bit in 2012 and enjoyed it. But it was, I was really thinking, I didn't really, the team piece, running the teams and being, you know, what I had done for so long, I didn't think I wanted to continue doing that. And I had got some calls about IndyCar in that time frame.
You been following IndyCar or been a fan?
Oh, for sure. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, motorsports. I mean, yeah. So I've, you know, followed IndyCar my whole life. I mean, when I think of where I grew up, IndyCar was way more prevalent than NASCAR, you know, when I was very young. So I was always a big IndyCar fan. Again, started getting some calls. There was the opening for the chief revenue officer piece. And again, even that, if you look back to that time frame, I was never in sales
ever.
But that's all I did. sell things all the time, because if we didn't sell things, we didn't eat, right? Or we didn't race. So when at MB2, I was the sales guy. I mean, we didn't have a sales staff. It was, you know, me. So between the competition stuff and that, so you're doing both because you have to. So I think I was recommended from a few people, and it was, I think at the point at that time, it was really, there was an opening, and I could fill it based on my history, but that wasn't necessarily, what I had done my whole career, you know. But it was something I saw a great opportunity to help something that I felt passionate about, that we could make a difference, right? So, you know, I was lucky to get the job, and, you know, we did that for 2 years.
So let's end on this. First day in the office in IndyCar. What's that like for you? The move from team ownership, team management, so many years to sanctioning body, the heart of running a racing series, but something, while you'd been a fan, hadn't been part of your experience beforehand. What's that first day in the job like for you? Looking around like, this is weird or different, or was it like new frontier?
Yeah, for sure new frontier. Because, again, so much of it was familiar, even, you know, being at the Speedway. Even from a NASCAR perspective, we participated in the first test in 90, whatever.
Three-ish or so.
The first test that we had, yeah. And then the first race. And it had always been, and I'd been to the Indy 500 before that, you know, growing up. And I probably went to two or three in the 80s, you know. So, no, it felt, I certainly knew Tony, you know. Mark, I had not known until.
Tony George, Mark Miles.
Yeah, until I'd got there. Or till, you know, till we met the first time on an interview type situation. But no, it felt very natural. And it was cool because when we first got there, I certainly, like I did before I got there, I thought I could help. And when I got there, I, you know, looked around. I'm like, yeah, we could, you know, there's some things I think we can do pretty quickly to get organized a little differently and get things rolling the right direction, hopefully. And not saying it wasn't before, but I just had some opinions on how we could do some things. And, you know, right off the bat, we had some pretty good, the Verizon title sponsor of the league, that got done pretty quick, and a couple other things happened. Chevy renewal, Sunoco renewal, Panasonic. And again, the Sunoco people I dealt with for a long time, the Chevy people I dealt with, you know, over the years a lot. So it was really, we plugged in and here we go.
That's a hell of a first hour, Mr. Fry.
Well, thank you. This is great.
Wait till we get.
I guess.
Well, hopefully, folks don't throw rocks at us and chase us with lit torches or anything.
Nighttime entertainment. Hopefully everybody just didn't go to sleep.
No. Well, we have some even more fascinating stuff to talk about on the IndyCar front and the impact you've had and the general approaches to the things that you've done or helped support to get done. The support you've given a lot of other folks to do what they do. That's a part I'm really, really looking forward to and a part to, because I know that's an area that I get a lot of fans asking about. Hey, it seems like they're doing more things correctly than incorrectly. How does that change happen? The fact that our friend and colleague Robin Miller isn't writing some sort of weekly IndyCar is being run by a bunch of jackasses and it's the worst thing ever. That's another metric I use too. So I look forward to finding some more time for a part two.
Well, me too. I appreciate you having me. Thank you.
And that was our friend Jay Fry. Look forward to grabbing that part two. Definitely going to dive into more about the decision-making, team building, coalition assembling, all the things that have helped take IndyCar from a place where, honestly, we weren't always happy. A lot of complaints, a lot of questions about why are you doing this, guys? And again, not saying that's gone 100%, just saying that the general state of happiness, I would say, is higher than it's been in a really long time. And lots and lots of credit to Jay and his competition team with Tino Belli, Bill Pappas, and many, many others. Well, again, if you get a chance, would greatly appreciate if you could subscribe here on iTunes, Podbean, and especially on the newish and growing Marshall Pruitt YouTube page. And with my pandering and pleading done, let me do my usual here and say, all right, I'm Marshall Pruitt. This is the Marshall Pruitt Podcast presented by Cooper Tires. Thank you for listening.